Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
City, it's the Gary Nall Show, and now your host, Gary Nall.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this empowering hour. There's going to be a lot of quality information on health and healing shared. We're going to show you all about the benefits of walking for healing the body, mind, and spirit with my guest Carolyn Quirchy in about 40 minutes. We will be taking your calls in about 15 minutes, and I intend to set a lot of time aside to hear what's on your mind, your questions or concerns, and a commentary a little later from Tom Englehart on Whose Hands, Whose Bloods, Killing Civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq from Tonda Satch. Let's begin. Nitrate in beetroot juice lowers blood pressure. Now, I've seen people generally, not in the United States, but in Scandinavian countries, use beetroot as a common remedy. And traveling around the world and always being curious about what they use in the way of herbs or greens or vegetables, this was rather novel at the time. Well, now a study at Queen Mary University in London, published in the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension, shows that the nitrate content of beetroot juice is a major cause for lowering blood pressure, and this was a major study. So what you have to do is just start throwing some beetroots in with your juicing. A good combination would be celery, cucumber, and beetroots. It's easy to find. You can find them in any grocery store, farmer's market. We have a lot of people in America who are depressed for a lot of reasons. Well, how we go about treating that depression is almost always the problem. More often than not, the majority of people treat it with antidepressants or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which really don't work. All the major studies show they don't work. Or we use alcohol, marijuana, a lot of different things to use, none of which deals with the underlying depression. Here's a natural way to help depression, and it works. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. It showed that the omega-3 fatty acids at 2,000 milligrams made a major difference. This was done at the University of Montreal. Quote, this was the largest study ever conducted assessing omega-3's efficacy in treating major depression. It was carried out in conjunction with researchers at centers affiliated with the university, including McGill University and Queen's University in Kingston, and they found that it made an enormous difference. It also helped people with anxiety disorders. So that is a natural, non-toxic, inexpensive way to help yourself or someone you care about. Give them 1,500 milligrams. That would be one capsule in the morning and one in the afternoon. So just that by itself, in major depression, made a major difference. I remember when I first had Dr. Benson from Harvard on, who was the feel-good doctor up there, and talked about the power of the mind. At that time, the field of psychoneuroimmunology was already very robust. Since then, there have been thousands of articles showing that what you think, how you think, can directly impact your physical well-being, as well as your emotions. This is just the latest in the mind-body therapy. And this is for fibromyalgia. Now, a lot of people suffer from fibromyalgia. It's a major cause of pain, especially in women. And in this study, they had women 45 years or older who suffered from fibromyalgia, and then they gave them a technique called affective self-awareness. And it made a major difference in reducing their pain over a 6-month period. In fact, 46% of all the women had a major increase in feeling better and reduction of pain. And this was published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. So, body-mind, it was all about thinking positive thoughts. Positive thoughts, positive outcome. Also, those of you who, like myself, are athletic and you don't want to lose body mass when you're doing heavy workouts, which can happen, especially if you're training for marathons. And I remember being in the very first Marine Corps Marathon in Washington, D.C., and our program is broadcast today at WPFW, where I've been on the air for 25 years every week, not missing a single week in 25 years. And I remember doing that marathon. I had trained awful hard. I wanted to do well, and also when you do a first marathon, it's always fun. You get to see the sights of the city. It wasn't a very well-organized marathon. In fact, it was. I remember a bunch of us, we were running about a 6:10 pace to begin, which is a pretty good marathon, and there was no water. And they had these small tables set up, and they hadn't anticipated having water for every athlete at every water stop. So by the 10th mile, we still hadn't had any water at all, and people were handing around ice cubes to suck on to get some water. And I kept hearing people saying, "Permission to pass, sir." And I didn't know that the Marines were asking the officers permission to pass in a marathon. That was rather bizarre. Anyhow, almost no one turned out to see it. I'd never seen a marathon with less spectators. But it was the first. They would learn a lot from that and improve their marathon since then. In any case, back then, I didn't know about creatine. Nobody knew about creatine. As a result, you could really look skinny by the time you finished a marathon. Now you don't have to. Now you can keep your body weight up, your muscle mass in good rip shape. And the way you do that is with creatine monohydrate. Now, this is a journal published in Nutrition, peer-reviewed journal, and it says that they want to test whether or not a low dose of creatine supplements can improve muscle function and hence reduce fatigue. Now, as most people in nutrition know, creatine is an amino acid-like compound. It was first identified back in the 1830s and for its presence in muscle. And it's been the subject of about 70 randomized controlled trials just over the last 12 years. And almost all of them came up with the conclusion that it improves performance. However, according to the authors of the current study, there was a gap in the literature regarding the effects of low-dose creatine. Most people I know generally took it at 5,000 milligrams. If you just too high, you get diarrhea. So anyhow, in here, they took a group of healthy men and women, randomly received either creatine supplements or a placebo. And the creatine was really at a low dose. Wasn't very much. And it was about, what was it, I think 300 milligrams. Anyhow, at the end of a six-week period, researchers found that the supplementation did not result in any significant difference in body mass, but it did, however, increase the resistance to fatigue. So if you want to exercise, I would suggest taking 3 to 5,000 milligrams of creatine monohydrate a day to keep your muscle mass up and the strength of your muscles, the endurance of your muscles, and overcome fatigue. So this showed that the low dose doesn't give you the protection of your muscle mass, and at the higher dose is what you really need. And finally, for those of you who, as I do, believe that antioxidants are one of the most important things you can take into your system, there's a good study, and it showed that long-term supplementation with antioxidants was beneficial, and especially for people who had problems with their heart, fat metabolism, and sugar metabolism. It really made your arteries more flexible. And this was in Nutrition and Metabolism, and it was a study involving 70 people with high blood pressure, diabetes, and who were smokers. And they gave them coenzyme Q10 today, 120 milligrams. I would suggest they start at 500 milligrams. They gave them vitamin C at 1,000 milligrams. They should start at 10,000 milligrams. They gave them 400 units of vitamin E. I would start them at 800 units of vitamin E. And they left out over 30 other different antioxidants simply because they're illiterate. And it's amazing how stupid scientists can be when they're so monotheistic in their focus. They just keep doing the same thing over and over again. But in spite of that, the researchers said, quote, in their final published article, the antioxidants play an essential role in the electron carrier in the mitochondrial oxidative system, improving endothelial function in diabetic patients, and that the antioxidants provide significant protection for the coronary artery endothelium against damage by oxidative stress, unquote. In lay language, that simply means that when you take antioxidants, you're helping the body, you're lessening the opportunity for heart attack and stroke and cancer, because the free radicals, which really do the damage inside our body, those are trapped and neutralized by antioxidants. Hence, the more varied the antioxidant selection from foods, juices, and supplements, the more these free radicals you grab and neutralize, and the healthier your tissue, and specifically your arterial tissue, your epithelium, the lining of your arteries, is protected. So you're going to live longer and be healthier, all other things being equal. So, one more reason, the more fresh juices, the more living foods, salads, vegetables, the less processed foods, the more antioxidants, the better it is for you. Just one more study. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. You can watch our video stream. I'm broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. And we're about to commence in the next 2 months the construction of a major studio, television and radio, state-of-the-art. It will literally be as nice as anything on Fox or NBC or ABC. And it'll be here at our headquarters. And because we have an old theater built in 1910, that is one part of our office. It's a beautiful building we're in here at 83rd and Broadway. And this is a long time ago, over 100 years ago. And so it has like this 30-foot high ceiling. You don't find that in offices. So we're going to use that as our new studio because we have more and more people listening to the Progressive Radio Network. More people. For example, Kara Lee just came in studio. She's program director for Progressive Radio Network. Hi, Kara Lee.
Good afternoon, Gary.
We have a whole roster of new people coming on board. Do you want to tell us some of the names?
Sure,
and
Gary,
what they're talking about?
Of course, of course. We do have a couple new shows that are going to be starting in the near future. One of them is Michael Rupert, who is well known for all of his knowledge in the oil industry and runs Collapse.net. He's going to be doing a show on Sunday nights at 9 p.m. starting in the next couple weeks, dealing with those issues. We also have another show called CD's Grace Notes, starring CD, who is famous for being one of the originators of Lion King on Broadway, and you can actually hear her in the track recording. She'll be doing a show all about arts and culture and interviewing different people coming into the show each week. We have a couple new other shows that have recently just started, the main one being If You Love This Planet, starring Dr. Helen Caldicott, and that's Sundays at 3 p.m., and that's an environmental show where she takes on guests and talks about different things that are happening in the environment each week.
And she is joined, and they are joined by Dr. Michio Kushi, Kaku, and also Danny Schechter. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of outstanding producers. And the one thing that differentiates our programs, first, even though we are heard, and my program was the number one listened to on NPR, we are not afraid to go after any issue that's important. We don't care about funding. No one has to fundraise. You'll never hear anyone pledging for money on any of the shows except me, because I'm the sole funder for the entire network. But also, it's empowering network. One of the reasons, and you brought this to my attention before the show today, about how low some of the numbers are, some of the traditional liberal or democratic programming on some of the non-commercial stations around the United States. Remember you?
Yeah, we were talking about that. Democracy Now! Is...
Well, no, don't mention any names.
Okay.
But some shows are in the toilet as far as their numbers. I mean, they're just in the hundreds. I mean, could you imagine being in a major city like Washington, D.C. or New York and having only hundreds of listeners? It's just unfathomable. But that's part of what people don't know. Now, when you get the ratings, you see it. So all PR and spin aside, you see the truth. And you ask me why... Why is it that so many of the traditional and well-known programs from the left are dying? And why are so many of the programs on the right exceeding? And I can give you my thought on that. I believe that on the left, it's because there's too much focus upon the negative. In other words, showing a problem... And legitimately so, but not showing the solutions. So people don't feel empowered. If you want to empower people, you have to give them constructive tools for social change. Consistently, not episodically. And if you lay on so much negativity all the time, it's a downer. And we already have so much negative in our society. People are challenged by so many things today that the last thing they want to do is turn on a radio or television program and watch someone bring us more bad news. I mean, how many plane crashes, murders, rapes, children dying in fires, or political scandals, or politicians' sex lives exposed, or stupid statements, or how much of that can you actually absorb? And what happens to you when you do? Tell me how any of that makes you a better person. Tell me how that makes it a better world for us. It doesn't. And I believe that the left has not understood where we're at. This past week, I went for my annual little spiritual retreat where I climb up into the mountains. I have some photographs of that up on my website today. I don't know the altitude I was at, but the last sign I saw, which was 5 hours before I stopped climbing, was about 8,000 feet, so I'm going to guess I was up around 11,000, 12,000 feet. And there I like to spend time alone with just nature. In fact, there was just a person who was hiking, came by, and I had my camera, and I got him to take a picture. I like to document the different things I do. But outside of that, I'm just sitting in one place and meditating. I generally take nothing more, no tents, no knapsacks, no food, just water. And I meditate on one thing only and nothing else as I'm looking at this beautiful, beautiful mountain range in front of me. I ask, have I stayed too long in this current space? If so, I must now learn the lessons of where I've been and prepare myself for my next step in this life. And those are very hard to come to by most people, because we don't like leaving where we're at, especially if we're comfortable. If we have a job that's paying us, if we have a family, if we have a neighborhood we're used to, we like patterns. Now, especially if you're an adaptive supporters are not going to change. They can live at the high end of their existence with a real sense of community and love, and there's not a whole lot of complexity there, and there shouldn't be. But for someone like myself, the dynamic assertive, dynamic aggressive, and the creative assertives, we have to grow, and the only way we can grow is to acknowledge when it's time to say goodbye, and it's time to say hello. The trouble is we don't know what the next step will be, and that unfolds as you make it up. You literally have to make it up as you go along, because in effect, you have to create your own life. You're not living through other people or from other people. You're sharing with other people, But each day you wake up, you literally have to be the person that's going to be responsible at the end of the month for making the decisions that are going to bring you an income. Then you say, will I compromise just to bring in an income? And for a lot of life energies, that's a challenging choice to make. And if you get comfortable and if you get successful, you stop growing. You stop challenging. You stop probing. And you stop looking for the truth outside of the truth that you have held, which no longer may be the truth you need. It's not as if we learn one truth and we carry that through the rest of our lives. We have to learn things that at one moment we can live with and accept, and another moment we have to surrender. In fact, in effect, to really grow, you have to have the capacity to say, I'm willing to learn something even if it contradicts something I'd previously held close. On my last show at noon, I mentioned to you that one of the problems with religion is that it goes from the ultra-Orthodox, which doesn't change ever, and is the most problematic, and is one of the primary causes of strife and conflict. Just look at the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. That is the extreme elements of the Islamic belief. But then you have Orthodox, and then you have conservative, then you have Reform. Well, if you get below Reform, what you generally have is observant, but they can, you know, they're not really engaged. Well, the moderates, and even dare say it's humanly possible to have progressives, have to be between the observant and the reformist. They're not going to go beyond that. You're just not going to find that. But you have a whole full spectrum, right? So it depends upon what your conditioning has been up to that point, is what your views of the world are and other people and your roles and your software, what you're going to eat and drink and wear, what other people are supposed to, whether someone will offend you if they say the wrong thing or eat the wrong thing. You're just a series of conditioned responses ready to go off. So we ask, how could someone stone yesterday in Iran a young couple who did nothing wrong except want to spend the rest of their life together in marriage? But their family hadn't arranged the marriage, and therefore they had sinned. And therefore, under Sharia law, which is ultra-radical, I mean, it's off-the-chart radical, they were to be stoned. And to be stoned, you're buried so that your hands and your arms are underground, but your chest is up. And then your villagers and family are responsible to look at you as they kill you, completely mutilate you. What kind of religion is that that would allow that? Well, then you could say, okay, in Christianity, I can show you texts where you can beat a baby's head against rocks. What kind of God would do that? What kind of person would rape a woman? No, rape all the women in a village. But the Crusaders did. And the Catholic Church advocated the destruction of any Indian that wouldn't convert to Christianity in the First Continent invasions. Estimated 25 million Indians were killed in South America and Central America, and 10 million in North America. That's 35 million people that religion, ultra-Orthodox, caused the death of. But what if you went to the other end, to those who look at all life as sacred, irrespective of your religion or philosophical or racial positioning? So what happens when the day comes, if that day ever comes, where you say, I have to say goodbye to this passage? If I want to be able to tolerate others with different views, I can no longer hold on to the position of intolerance. And there are so few people in this world who are willing to open the door and allow us to walk through into intolerance, acceptance, compassion, love. Instead, we find so many people who say, come through this door and be indoctrinated into our cult, or into our orthodox religious views, and then we will be there to protect you and guard you. And then you look around, we have presidents of the United States, like George Bush and others, who said he went, crusade and going out to kill those Iraqis and terrorists. In the name of God. Which God is that? The God of the ultra-Orthodox hate? One of rape? One of genocide? Yeah. It shows you that he would have been a different president had he been a different man, and he wasn't a different man because he wasn't willing to open another passage in his life and surrender the passages within and close it and learn the lessons of it. And if we're not able or willing at any time to learn the lessons of our passage, then we are doomed to repeat them ad nauseum and expect an outcome that is not going to happen. you will not get a positive outcome when you stay stuck. So in that little journey, you have to be alone, you have to be with nature with no distractions, and in that moment you come to grips with the idea of where should you go, what should you do, and appreciate all the lessons you have learned so you don't have to repeat them. And then you step forward, in effect, on a new learning curve. It's exciting, it's exhilarating, and especially for someone like myself, and I look at what's possible. Well, we're going from this studio we're in now to a larger studio, you know, to broadcast all over the world and for television programs. We're going to do a lot of things, but all of it based upon empowerment, all of it based upon helping people who need help, not just pointing fingers and saying this person's wrong and that person's wrong, but what do we do to heal our bodies, our minds, our society? We know for a fact our government's not going to participate because no one in that government's willing to acknowledge that they've stayed too long under corruption, influence peddling, megalomania, insecurity. They became a politician for the wrong reason. They didn't go to Washington to be a reformer. They went to Washington because they needed acknowledgement, and with that, so easily co-opted and compromised. And many people in the media are no different. All the media cover the same stories the same way, just from different political persuasions. I don't care if you watch Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow on one side and Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity on the other. The same stories. But what stories aren't they covering that we need to hear about? We need to hear, how do we actually help people who are starving? How do we help the homeless? How do we help people who are just regular middle-class Americans have a quality of life? How do we get more equality into their paychecks? How do we balance our budgets? How do we identify people who are lying to us so that we look, it's very positive, very self-empowering when you finally realize, gee whiz, I didn't know how easy it was to look at someone and tell whether or not they were lying to me. Simple. Any politician, look at their voting record, look at where they got their money, and look what they stood up for and refused to compromise on. And then you'll see. I would rather see a politician stand on virtue and lose a vote than compromise on the vote and lose virtue. Because with virtue, you have a chance of change. Without virtue, there is no change, ever. And the best example of someone who is totally compromised is are virtually not one person, but all the presidents we had in the United States, going clear back to Jimmy Carter. Grossly compromised, flawed human beings. And we think this is the best we can do, then the problem is not them, it's us. And these are the best politicians we can come up with. Again, the problem is not the conceit of these politicians. It is us. It is we who believe in them. So at the point where we're able to actually identify our own weaknesses and limitations and surrender them and grow, then no longer are we going to be so easily victimized, and we start looking for the positive. That said, now take a look at your programs on the left and the right. They're highly radicalized. They're toxic and negative, even when true, in part or whole, and they're not empowering at all. In fact, all they empower is the continuation of the problem. The Democrats wanted to elect two grossly flawed human beings on all levels. The first one, Al Gore. Did we forget, or did we not have the intellectual decency and honesty to acknowledge that Al Gore was the co-president with Bill Clinton? He was the one who did not stand up and challenge the administration on the landmines, that we refused to sign the abolishment of all landmines and going out and picking them up and cleaning them up to save lives. He was the one who refused to acknowledge the power of the major oil cartels and get us into solar. And he was the one who was still getting his family farm subsidized by the tobacco lobby. This whole thing about his, you know, doing a film, which was a fair film, not a great film, and how he's exploited it since then for his own personal gain, that's called disaster capitalism. He and Bill Clinton are masters of it. They compromised the environmental movement, the human rights movement. I didn't see that Al Gore marched into the White House one day and said, you know, you must intervene in Rwanda. It is genocide. We know it's genocide. and we have a more responsibility to stop the Hutu from destroying the Tutsi. He didn't do it. So you must judge a person by what they don't do with foreknowledge of an event, not just what they do. So he would have been no better of a president than Bill Clinton, and look at the disaster of GATT and after the World Trade Organization, 5 million American jobs lost because of him, the evisceration of the Glass-Steagall Act, which allowed the Wall Street gambling, this entire disaster, it was the architect of four men, Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, Bill Clinton, and a congressman from Texas, Republican. Do you know his name?
No, Gary, who are you talking about?
Think for a moment. Phil, know the last name? I bet someone in the audience does. Now, let's see if they do. If they didn't, they call and tell us. So what we have then is we have the Democrats refusing to acknowledge the limitations and simply looking at, well, who could get elected? What would it matter if the person doesn't have the ethics to actually engage in honest change and stand firm and trust that the American public will stand behind them, than if there's just a series of compromises, at the end of the day, all we have is disaster. And look what we have today. Disaster. Both by Republicans and Democrats. So what happens is then people want to see something that actually empowers them and deals with issues that we're not otherwise hearing about, or hearing different perspectives on those issues that actually give us an insight, and the insight itself becomes empowering. So how you deal with the topic can make it an empowering topic. And that's the reason. And as you saw, we've been breaking records almost weekly in numbers of people. 1 month, 1,122,000 people came on board just to download the show, just downloading it. Unheard of numbers. Why? Because they are the people who finally reached the time in their life where they're saying they've got to change. They're exiting passages and entering a new place, and with that new place, they're open to new ideas that previously they might have not been interested in. So I think that's what's important.
Thank you very much, Gary.
What else you got there? And then we're going to go to our calls. I promised the audience we'd take time aside to take your calls. And we're going to do that now. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. One last thing. Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, your day has come and gone. Independents, once they do get organized, will lead our country to a better way. So we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. I'm going to intersperse your questions or comments with that of... I just was told my guest is on the line. Let's just run over there right and say hello to her. I just want to have her on here for a little bit. Carolyn Scott Corchi, K-O-R-T-G-E. She's an award-winning journalist who's written on athletics and jogging for 20 years, as well as on... She's an accomplished competitive runner, and... She is the author of The Spirited Walker and recently Healing Walks for Hard Times. Nice to have you with us today, Carolyn.
Thanks, Gary. I'm glad to be with you.
Carolyn, talk about, from your research and your experience, how walking helps us and on what level does it help us so people can get hopefully a little motivated to start power walking.
Sorry, Gary.
Hello?
Gary, I can't hear you.
Okay, we'll ask the engineer to put up the volume a little bit.
Oh, I know. It's just that there was a static happening, but you were... Shall I just talk a little bit now? Am I coming through?
Loud and clear.
All right. Well, you were asking about how walking can help us in hard times. I think that's what you were asking. I think it helps both on physical and the spiritual, symbolic levels. As you mentioned, I have been walking for 20 some years and did competitive race walking, not competitive running. I'm really, my first experience with the healing power of walking came as a competitive race walker. I grew up at a time when I wasn't in an environment where I wasn't athletic at all. It was in my 40s that I started walking, and the first thing I learned was that in order to be successful, I had to learn to use my mind and body together. That had been new to me. I always thought that I was a physical klutz, and that my only competitive achievement would be in intellectual or professional areas. So when I learned to walk with mind and body together, you know this, I know, because you're a marathon runner. You can't succeed if your mind is not assisting your body. The first healing there for me was in healing a split. I became whole in a way that I think athletes definitely know, where you have a sense of all of you working toward one goal. It was a new and profound experience of healing, and out of that came the spirited walker. But really, then I knew that, and then it was after I wrote the spirited walker about that kind of healing of my own personal wholeness that I was diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years after that book came out. And I knew by then that walking was more than a fitness activity for me. I mean, it was definitely fitness. It was invigorating the way I was walking as a race walker, but it was more than that. It was my meditation. I had learned how to make walking be, and people know this. People know who pray. Many people know who walk that it does more than move your body. It moves your spirit. It moves your mind. But in hard times, that became harder to do. Not walking. I knew I had to walk, but slowing down the terror that struck when I first heard that I had breast cancer. That terror, that spin of a fear, of uncertainty, of self-doubt, what did I do to cause this, all those horrible questions that go screaming through the mind. I knew that I had to walk through that somehow to find a solid ground again. And for me, that meant I had to actively discipline that screaming part of my mind by simply saying, one step forward at a time. I mean, I couldn't get through that whole cycle without my mind interrupting something, but I come back to it one step forward at a time. It was imposing a meditation on my walk so that I could activate what really I consider the healing powers of walking, and that is that it reduces stress, it improves creativity, it increases memory, problem-solving skills. You know, we read these studies every day in magazines and papers, but acting on what we know in a time of challenge is difficult, even though we know. For me, it became as simple as stepping into the truisms of our language, getting my feet back on the ground. As I said, one step at a time, restoring balance, momentum. Through my treatment for cancer, I, which was about a year of surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, I walked very regularly. I walked slower and shorter than I had before. I walked with friends who supported me. But I walked because I believed that that movement, that walking, was actually telling my cells, my physical cells and my spiritual being, that I wasn't stopping. I wasn't giving up. I was going on. I was moving through this crisis. Well, that didn't cure my cancer. I think it's important to distinguish between healing and curing. I mean, my walking supported the treatment I was taking, but what it healed was the chaos, the fear, the sense of shattered image I had of myself. I couldn't view myself as a strong, healthy woman suddenly. I didn't know who I was. I had reaffirmed that by walking, moving through that one step at a time. We know that about that sort of spiritual healing that can happen by movement, and that I think healing is about healing emotionally, healing spiritually, healing your trust, your faith. But there's also a physiological healing that happens with movement. Literally, if you're walking at a brisk pace, you're getting in generally 10 times as much oxygen when sitting still, 10 times. That's the fuel of life. That's the energy. That's the fuel of your cells. That oxygen changes the chemistry of your body. It's very easy for posture to collapse. And I'm not just talking about cancer. I'm talking about loss of a job. I'm talking about depression, the death of a spouse, a child, a heart condition. In any of these times, it's easy to kind of just feel your body cave in, collapse, slump. Just changing that by walking, standing upright, filling it with air, stimulating the cells, literally changes chemistry. It changes your, Herbert Benson was a real leader in research about the relaxation response, and Herbert Benson really found that stress release happened very, very effectively for people who walked and simply said in, out, with their breath as they walked, as opposed to people who walked and let things stew around in their heads. So literally what happened for those people who got stress release was that cortisol levels go down. As cortisol levels go down, the body has a chance to return to its natural healing abilities. Neuropeptides go up, mood increases. Benson's work was really fundamental for me, but lots of work since then certainly supports the value of adding a mental component to your physical movement, to making it a mindful movement. I think if you walk long enough, hikers know this, if you walk long enough, you're going to reach that point of peace that settles into the body and the mind. But if you only have 10 minutes, say, it can be equally, well, maybe not equally, it can be a profoundly effective if you can combine mind and movement together in 10 minutes of movement. Robert Thayer, who's a researcher in Southern California, he's a research psychologist who wrote a book called The Origin of Everyday Moods and whom I interviewed for Healing Walks for Hard Times. He says that 10 minutes of brisk walking can increase energy levels for up to 2 hours. That's a profound payback for 10 minutes of walking, because increased energy levels correlate to increased mood. When your energy's up, your mood tends to be up. When your mood and energy are up, your resourcefulness is up. That's a tremendous healing step to take when you're in a hard time. But it's difficult. What I mean by difficult is it's hard to take the first step. It's hard to get yourself motivated. When I finished with my cancer treatment, I returned to the center where I'd been treated and said, you know, walking was so important to me. I'd like to volunteer and teach a series of walking classes in the parking lot for patients and their families or their supporters. And I taught a 6-week series of classes, and it was tremendously important to me to be able to share walking. But what I learned from that was that other people were finding this helpful also. That the opportunity put me in contact with a group, U.S. Oncology Group, that had Life Beyond Cancer retreats at Miraval, and I taught there on their faculty for the last 9 years. And many other teaching experiences have come out of it. And as I taught people in hard times in their life, every time we'd get to the end of a walk, people would say to me, this is just great. Do you have a handout? And I said, well, you know, it's really all in the Spirited Walker, basically, these ideas in the Spirited Walker. But I'd make a handout. Then gradually I realized that what people were asking for was a guide. I mean, they wanted a place to start and move through a series of walks. The Spirited Walker is fabulous and it's wonderful fun, but it's like a buffet table of wonderful things you might do with your mind and your body to stay motivated when you walk. Healing Walks for Hard Times, I think, is a distillation of that, in that it puts it into an 8-week walking program that offers walking tools, mental and physical, that gradually build and add each week new concepts. And it can begin with as little as 10 minutes a day, encouraging people to walk 6 days a week, even 10 minutes, if that's what you have, the strength or the time. If you can walk 20 minutes, there's a plan for 20 minutes. If you can walk 30 minutes, there's a plan for that. But each week it builds up a little. I'm hoping, I mean, the book is brand new. It's only a couple of weeks out. I'm hoping that it provides for people what I thought they were asking for. I'm excited about it. So what else do you want me to say?
No, you've said it all, and I appreciate it very much. As a power walker for the last 20 years, I ran before that, and I really appreciate it. So hopefully people will read Healing Walks for Hard Times. Thank you very much, Caroline Corgi, for coming on. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Then we're taking your calls. 888-874-4888.
This song we're singing, why don't you sing it? You hold the key in the palm of your hand.
We're going into the last segment of our program, all about you. Whatever questions, comments, thoughts you have, now you have a chance to share them. 888-874-4888. Tomorrow at noon, we'll be talking with Dr. Michael Gurian on the invisible presence, how a man's relationship with his mother affects his relationship with women. I thought that we'd have a social philosopher on and talk about some of the challenges that women find with men who have trouble relating in a way that can create the harmony and peace, joy and love and spontaneity and passion that they deserve in their relationships. He's from Harvard and Johns Hopkins and Stanford, so he'll be an interesting guest. Let's go now and say hello to Rodney from Washington, D.C. Hi, Rodney.
Hello, Gary. How are you today?
I'm excellent.
Great. Did you move your headquarters to another location?
Headquarters is still the same, 83rd and Broadway.
I know the number had changed, so I thought that you might have moved. At any rate, always a great show, and congrats on your rave ratings. So, you really seem to be pleased about that.
What I'm pleased about, Rodney, is I'm pleased about how many people are awakening themselves to how much potential for change they have outside of the box. They're no longer waiting for someone else to make up their mind for them or to guide them, because they see how compromised so many of our institutional directives and institutional leaders are.
Right. So, I had an answer for your question. I think
I'm
trying
it?
To pose a question to the lady guest or...
the senator from Texas.
Yeah, Phil Graham.
Phil Graham.
Okay, that was just an answer. I didn't know where you were going with that thought, but interest to me is the recent debacle regarding the building of a Muslim mosque near Ground Zero. And I heard it posited on WPFW this morning for their community comments segment. And I guess looking at it purely objectively, as I do most of the topics that I hear, including yours, seems as if people have forgotten all the in-depth studies that were done on the involvement and causation of the perpetrators of 9/11, and that seemingly... hasn't seemed to sink in, including yourself. I think you've done numerous in-depth studies of 9/11. Causation.
Correct. I spent 15 minutes on my noon show, which is now on the archives, answering this. But a very short answer would be this: legally, absolutely, they have a right to build on any private property they choose. But ethically and morally, that is something that I am absolutely against. Because that would be no different, as I said, than building a Shinto for the Japanese at Pearl Harbor, or for the German Christian party at that time to build a socialist Christian party, which ended up being the Nazis for example, at a concentration camp.
Well, were they in chain of custody ownership of that parcel of property?
That I do not know. But here's what's important: if they chose to build a multi-denominational cultural center where not the ultra-Orthodox or the Orthodox of any religion who are intemperate, who are frequently racist, but rather the true reformers and the moderates come together and work with Jews and Christians and Buddhists and Islamics and Muslims, working together, then I would say fine, because you have something that is constructed that will come from that.
So you felt as though it should be a multi-denominational type of center as opposed to strictly Muslim. And I don't even know what persuasion of Islam is being practiced in this mosque.
They haven't explained that, because once again, the vast majority of Islamic practitioners are moderate or observers, but in those countries where we've seen Sharia law, and Sharia law comes through in some of the mosques where you do not have a head of that mosque who is willing to stand up and challenge it. And I wish that we had a greater reform movement within Islam. We do have some voices, absolutely, and I respect those voices, but they are the minority, because around the world, it is the extremists that are the most dangerous. By the way, that's also true in Christianity and or in Judaism. You know, it is your extremist in Judaism that wants to bomb Iran without concern of the consequences to America, the world. It's the extremist in Christianity that created the Crusades and the destruction and support of slavery and the destruction of the Native Americans. So you have to look on a spectrum of where on the spectrum is a person's ideology resting. And upon that basis, you will see whether it will end up being a place of peace and harmony, of one, a breeding ground for a breeding ground for terrorists. And that has not. If they want to do it right, then they should go back and reevaluate and do it completely differently and realize the sensitivity that a lot of people who are victims have because of how this was done. And that's our issue. Thank you very much.
So you think it would be akin to building a shrine for Reichmann, Germany, near the Holocaust?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is no different, in my opinion.
Right.
And because you do not, first of all, they have, where is the money coming from? You know, if it's coming from Saudi Arabia, let me be very clear and unequivocal, irrespective of the group think in Washington among the political elites. Saudi Arabia is a vastly racist, vastly sexist, vastly terrorist country.
Well, you know, Mayor Bloomberg is Jewish, and he said he applauded President Obama in his observation of it, I guess.
Mayor Bloomberg is a rich little diminutive soul who had enough money to buy himself a mayorship of an important city. That does not make him enlightened or progressive in any way. All right? And I am tired of hearing people who are in positions of power assume that we should defer to them because of their position of power. When was the last time you had Chris Hedges or myself or Gerald Salante or any of thousands of progressive minds on to debate the issues? You never see us, because we would bring a completely different perspective. So what you have in all this, I mean, I'm embarrassed by this Ron Williams and these other people who call themselves liberal going on these shows. They are an apologist. They are appeasers. They're the Neville Chamberlains of our time, you know, who just can't see the truth that we have both Democrat and Republicans who act the same and support the same, because they are supported and controlled by the same agenda. That's why we have to look at the next level of change, and that will come through the independent movement. It is not organized. It is not filled with any sense of cooperation at this moment, but over the next 4 years, when you finally see how bad we get, when Sarah Palin is running on the right and Hillary Clinton on the left, and mark my words, Hillary Clinton will run, and Barack Obama wasn't smart enough to see how the Clintons, they filled in her resume. Why would she give up an important job like being Senator of New York for a Secretary of State? Because she was challenged in her, this is just elementary. One of the things that Obama challenged her repeatedly was that she did not have the international diplomatic resume. Well, this gave it to her. And And that's how politics works. It is dirty, it is loathsome, and most people today recognize it. They just haven't recognized their power to make more informed choices. And I think that we had better be a little more responsible. This would be like, to me, this would be like going into Detroit and building a 50,000-square-foot mansion for yourself in a ghetto. What are you trying to prove except to rub a little salt into the wounds of people who are hypersensitive? Remember, you must distinguish what is legal from what is ethical. And we have a lot of laws that do not mean that there's an ethic behind them. Rodney, thank you very much.
I tend to agree with you. Thanks, Gary.
All the best to you. I'm out of time. I'm sorry for the other people who didn't get a chance to get online, but I will have tomorrow a show at noon, and I'll have you come on at the first of it. So call back tomorrow. And yes, we do not have a third party in the United States. How much does that tell us about our unwillingness to see the truth outside of two ideologies? Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Kara Lee.
You took my love and now you're gone. Since I fell.